RadioInfluence.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dark to Light with Cranky Val and the ghost of Tracy Beans. As you all know, Tracy is off on important business. She's in D.C. for a little bit, shaking hands, wheeling and dealing, doing her thing, seeing the sights. And she's left me with the responsibility, this is a great honor right here, to host Dark to Light all by myself. I was hoping that I could have gotten a guest for tonight, but the week was so crazy and it was shortened by the holiday, and I wasn't able to line anything up. And Tracy, of course, has been busy as well. And it's been a crazy week for information, for everything else. So I'm going to do a little bit something different tonight. I want to bring a couple of things up that have been on my mind, things I've been seeing playing out over the last day or two. And I even have a little bit of reading to do for you, a little bit of history, and I don't know, just something a little bit different since it's a different week. And I know that a good portion of the male audience just turned off right now. That's what happened. Everybody was complaining that I spoke too much for the very pleasant voiced Tracy. I never want to step on her toes, but it's just you and me now. Now you can't get away from me. Now there's no getting away. So let's get into it, shall we? Here we go. The first thing I want to talk about is this New York Times resistance member. Now, we've been hearing a lot about this going on this week. And I want to just go right to the New York Times blog post as it is, because that's what this is, ultimately. This is the equivalent of an anonymous Tumblr blog entry. And the New York Times thought this would be a prudent thing to put on out there. And, we'll go into the complete lack of intuition that had to go into this. So I'm not going to go through the entire thing, but let's just jump in, shall we? Here's the headline. I'm sure you've heard of it. I am part of the resistance inside the Trump administration. I work for the president, but like-minded colleagues and I have vowed to thwart parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations. President Trump is facing a test to his presidency unlike any faced by any modern leader. It's not just that the special counsel looms large, or that the country is bitterly divided over Mr. Trump's leadership, or that this is being published on the New York Times, okay? One of the evil twin sisters between the New York Times and the Washington Post. This is being published on one of the evil twin sisters that are responsible, at least in the print aspect of the media, for actually bringing this divide to the forefront and making sure that the lines have been hardened and that the moderate middle is quickly evaporating. All right. So how amazing. Or even that his party might well lose the House to an opposition hell-bent on his downfall, even though it is not anything out of the realm of crazy that the party in power takes a hit in the midterms. Okay, that would actually be normal. Okay, that would actually be normal. So if there isn't a shellacking, and if the House majorities are maintained, that's history. That's history right there. You know, we're playing with House money here, everybody. We're up against somebody. We're up against a machine that did not think they were going to be beaten, that they had everything in place to not be beaten. Okay? In fact, there was some unrigging that was going on at the end. Think about that for a second. Leading into the 2016 election, you had places like the New York Times and CNN and all of these polls going out of their way to put the chances of a Clinton wipeout in the 90s. In the 90s, we're talking about the lowest I saw was 88% chance of Hillary Clinton winning the election. And then, of course, the highest was like 98% chance. That sounds like a media that kind of knows that the writing was on the wall. Okay, but something went wrong at the end. What could it have been? IDK. So let's just keep going a little bit. Ready? The dilemma, which he does not fully grasp, is that many of the senior officials in his own administration are working diligently from within to frustrate parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations. I would know. I'm one of them. To be clear, ours is not the popular resistance of the left. All right, we want the administration to succeed. To succeed and think that many of its policies have already made America safer and more prosperous. Okay, so they're picking and choosing. They're picking and choosing what parts of the president's agenda and his approach that he has been duly elected to go out there and achieve. They're picking and choosing what's going on here. Okay. Hey, I'm going to jump to one little excerpt over here. I want to go through the whole thing. They've talked openly about the 25th Amendment behind closed doors. They're talking about also talk about foreign policy. They say take foreign policy, for example. In public and in private, President Trump shows a preference for autocrats and dictators, such as President Vladimir Putin of Russia and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, which everybody loved during the Olympics, and displays little genuine appreciation for the ties that bind us to allied, like-minded nations. So I would first like to say that if this is really somebody inside of, you know, the executive's realm of influence, boy, oh boy, do they lack even common ability to look at what's going on here and see how the difference between dealing with the dictators and the autocrats that President Trump has patted on the shoulder and has given some kind of conciliatory praise in some way to soften them up and to make the grounds fertile for a deal that would, you know, I don't know, take nuclear arms off the Korean Peninsula. You have to understand this guy is used to dealing with barracudas on the international stage. Okay, CEOs and presidents of multinational corporations are no different sometimes than dictators of despot countries. Okay, in little blots on the map over there in the on the Korean Peninsula. So you think about this, and they still can't discern after all this time of dealing with Vladimir Putin, the little bit of the FaceTime he's had with Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un or the time he spent in the Middle East. You think about everything that he has said to soften things up, to make sure that the grounds are fertile for us to get what we want without, and I need to stress this, giving up anything. They think rhetoric, and they think that jockeying in a negotiation standpoint, to make the round table discussions of achieving whatever your ultimate goal is a little bit more fertile, a little more pliable. They think whatever has to be said and done, and whose shoulders need to be patted in front of a television camera, they think that is more dangerous than actually giving away things like selling off 20% of our uranium or giving so much to Iran with nothing. I mean, listen, you can say whatever you want about dealing with people in the Middle East. You can say what you want about a number of things out there and what we should or should not be involved in. Tell me what we got from the Iran deal. Not only did we get nothing and gave tons away and actually made things even more insecure in the event that Iran really is looking to develop nuclear weapons as fast as possible, as quickly as possible. Whether or not that is the case, what did we do? We gave away things. We didn't get anything in return. We didn't even get the assurances that it would make this world a safer place. Because when you look at the actual details of the deal, it gave us maybe a 10-year window where we don't have to worry as much, to give President Obama and whoever succeeds him time to get out of office and leave the bomb in whoever else's lap that comes next. And the other thing we gave away during all that was the treaty clause of the Constitution. Thank you to people like Bob Corker, who flipped the treaty clause of the Constitution on its own head to be able to get this through and try to redefine what a treaty is. So it's really amazing. It's amazing to see how these resistance staffers are even looking at what was going on inside the administration and how he's jockeyed and how he's positioned himself to try to get some of these things that he's set out to do off the table, checked off as completed. It's amazing. So someone claiming to be limiting the damage that Trump is doing to regular order in the executive branch, that's what this all is. Someone is claiming that they're limiting the damage that he's doing to regular order. That regular order, of course, being the reason that someone like me voted for Donald Trump in the first place, to go and destroy that. I didn't have anything. I really walked into that election with a cautious optimism, just because Donald Trump was an unknown. Hillary Clinton was a known. In fact, we knew too much about her. Okay? I voted for the Supreme Court, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and I voted for somebody to take it to the establishment, to beat back the establishment media, to talk about the culture a little bit more, to beat back political correctness, and to just shake up the status quo and be the monkey wrench in the gears. Who the hell wants anything that resembles regular order in this version of our government to stay intact? I don't know. Nobody I want to be friends with, that's for goddamn sure. And if I curse a little bit more on this, I'm trying to stay good for Tracy. I'm really trying to stay well-behaved for Tracy. But, you know, who is the anonymous resistor? Who is they? Can anybody tell me who they is? I don't know. But that is what has been breathlessly reported for God knows how long. You know, I mean, we're looking at something here where you have radio news briefs across the country. And I listen to a lot of different radio shows on TalkStream Live and stuff. So I actually get to hear the native ads. I get to hear native news briefs and all that stuff. So when I'm listening to like Clyde Lewis or something like that in the late night, I'm hearing about all the traffic reports in Portland, Oregon. But I listen to other shows as well. And this is what they're asking the last couple of days. Who is the anonymous resistor? We need to know. And they're so breathless when they cover this. But for one, I can tell you this. I don't know who it is. I can't even tell you that if it's really, I couldn't even tell you for sure if it's anybody that's actually in the administration. But for one, it is definitely someone who lacks even basic intuition. Because how will this be perceived? How will this be perceived by sane people, regardless of their personal political leanings? How would this be received? Are you telling me that a sane person will willfully cast aside our republic and cheer on the act of sedition itself? Because that's what this is. It's sedition. Executive branch sedition by an anonymous, self-appointed rat. A rat. Who is supposed to be happy that there is an anonymous, boasting rat picking and choosing what policies sink or what policies swim until they can safely get Trump out of the White House? Like they're trying to make sure that all of the sharp ends on the coffee tables in the White House are covered up and safe from Donald Trump until the child is escorted out of the White House, whether it be in 2021 or 2025. What is this? Who is supposed to be happy about this? No one. Only rats will cheer this. So rats are responsible for it, and rats will cheer this. And when I say responsible for it, I'm not even giving credence to the inference or the suggestion that they have been successful in what they're doing. Okay, I'm talking about, even if this is just the New York Times rolling something on out there that they know that they can get away with under the cover of anonymity, to try to create as much chaos, as much more suspicion as they can in the press, and of course, whatever kind of distrust that they can try to sow within the executive branch itself. Because the rats are not completely out of the executive branch in those agencies, so why not just throw it out there? You have the blanket, the warm blanket of anonymity. You know, so I want to take a little bit of a break from this. We're not done with the topic altogether, but I want to read to you something. A little something about one of the people who actually did infiltrate the White House and how drastically it was impacted. Now, I'm taking this from the book Blacklisted by History by M. Stanton Evans. Okay, it's the untold story of Senator Joe McCarthy, a guy who's gotten a completely bad rap and who was completely vindicated by Venona after the fall of the Soviet Union. But you want to see something? I want to read this to you. It's only a couple of paragraphs, but I think that you'll find it an interesting piece of history here. Easily, this is off page 43, easily the most important figure on this figure on this McCarthy list of 10 was Lachlan Curie, okay? An executive assistant to President Roosevelt in the early 1940s whose portfolio included policy toward China. Curie left the government in 1945, and though he was still around when McCarthy came along, would flee the country soon after. In trying to retrace the steps by which the U.S. government had been penetrated by communist and Soviet agents, McCarthy got on the trail of Curie and his multitude of contacts. Curie was, for instance, closely linked with Owen Lattimore, another rat, and with diplomat John Stewart Service. Arrested in the Amerasia case after sending back a stream of dispatches from China denouncing the anti-communist leader Chiang Kai-shek. Curie was also extremely thick with John Carter Vincent, the State Department official who played a critical role in shaping U.S.-Asia policy in the years before the Red Conquest of China. In addressing the debacle of U.S.-China policy, McCarthy charged that Lachlan Curie in the White House and John Carter Vincent and subsequently Alger Hiss in the State Department were exercising their influence at the Washington end of the transmission belt, conveying poisonous information from Chungking to the detriment of Chiang Kai-shek. The full outlines of Curie's part in the Great Betrayal have yet to be traced. That it was an important and essential part, I have no doubt, end quote. By Great Betrayal, McCarthy meant that the strategy of elements in the State Department and Treasury Departments and the White House to torpedo Chiang and advance the fortunes of his red opponents. This was certainly harsh invective against Curie, but totally justified by the record. Like others mentioned, Curie would appear in Venona as an agent of influence and spy for Moscow, bearing the cover name Page. And while he more than did his bit on China, his efforts were by no means confined to Asia. Here's the last paragraph. Venona reveals, for instance, that Lachlan Curie in 1944 told the KGB that President Roosevelt was willing to concede Soviet demands about the Polish-Russian border, which claimed for Stalin the territory he seized in 1939 when he and Hitler jointly invaded Poland and divided it between them. This intel was of utmost value to Moscow as it showed FDR breaking faith with the Polish government in exile, which opposed the Kremlin land grab. The Soviets thus knew that they need not fear a tough U.S. response as they dished the Poles, which they proceeded to do in brutal fashion until they totally conquered Poland. Not only did they totally conquer Poland, but they conquered most of Eastern Europe and as far as laying the groundwork for the rise of Mao and the Great Leap Forward over there, essentially opened up the doorways for as many as 45 to 100 million people to be killed either by starvation or by slave labor or anything else that the beauty of communism has brought to the world. That was an infiltration. That was an infiltration. So Lachlan Curie gave Eastern Europe and China to communism. And meanwhile, over here, the White House rat, who is secretly thwarting the president for 2 years so far, has given us what? A tamed North Korea, a growing economy, lower taxes and slash regulations, solid Supreme Court picks, promises kept on NAFTA, they exited the TPP, exited the Paris Climate Agreement, thumbing our nose at the UN and NATO, and the lowest jobless claims now in 50 years. Yeah, okay. That's quite an effective mole you got there, deep state. Quite an effective mole you got there. Either way, this is a psyop. Either way, even if there is someone on the inside or not, if there was someone on the inside with this kind of a Blues Brothers type of mission from God that they gave themselves to protect the status quo from Donald Trump, why pen this ridiculous blog post? I mean, just 2 years, I mean, just a couple of months before the midterms, in year two of the first term. Why would you say this? Think about that for a little bit. Why would you come out in year two, the halfway point of the first term of the presidency, to say that I am part of a resistance that is inside of the Trump administration looking to thwart parts of his plan? Why would you do that? It makes no sense. Not only is this the intuition of the person writing it, and of course it's being printed by the New York Times, which is actually very helpful to the communists during the World War, World War II. That's some interesting stuff there too. But why not say this after Trump leaves office altogether? It makes no sense. No sense whatsoever. So just leaving that out there, you can take what you want from that. Let's move on to something else. Oh, you know, before we move on, I don't have any things to say. I don't have any plugs or any reads to do tonight on behalf of Tracy. Nobody's given us any reads to do tonight. No sponsors for the show tonight. I was thinking about coming out here and making up fake sponsors like, I don't know, Happy Slappy Turkey, or I don't know what it was. I had a couple of really good ideas last night in the shower. That's where all my ideas go. And then, of course, they just drain down. They come. The water washes the ideas from my head, drains it down my back, down the crack of my ass. And then, of course, it's gone, drained away into the porcelain. That's it, because now I've forgotten everything. You know what I actually do have? I have this really interesting thing. Anybody out there who thinks as much as I do or listens to podcasts in the shower and all that stuff, get yourself, there's these notepads that you can stick to the tiles in your bathroom, in your shower. And I believe it's called a shower notes or something like that, where it is a type of material and you can rip it off almost like a post-it pad, a type of material, and it comes with a pencil that still functions in a moist, wet, like shower-like environment where you can write yourself notes in pencil. It works beautifully, so you don't lose any of those thoughts. That's what I should actually get as a sponsor. That's some real stuff. That's a great little piece of equipment. Lauren and I, my wife and I, we write ourselves notes all the time. And then, so it'll be like little love letters. And then in between, it's just me, you know, going on anti-communist rants. It's right there on the bathroom wall. Oh, gosh. But that's that. All right, let's move on to something else. That's how we segue into other things. Now, what I wanted to do here is I want to talk about not only Cory Booker, who is just a marble mouth bald asshole. I don't like him at all. He's a liar. I don't like his lazy eye. There's something wrong. There's something wrong with the way his mouth moves. And you can tell that he's just not a hard type of guy. He pretends to be this hard ass, but he's not. He's not. Okay. He just isn't. He uses just awful language. And I'm not saying like bad, like cursing. It's just his picks of how he chooses his words is so bad. Listen to this now. This is from 11 a.m. yesterday. Booker, Cory Booker from The Hill, releases confidential Kavanaugh documents. Now, you probably know where this all went. Listen to this guy speak just for a little bit. I don't know if you can hear it. Hold on.
The American people, regardless of your political perspective, should be outraged that we have a process that is keeping critical documents hidden from the rest of the American public.
Well, critical documents.
His tongue is like five times the size of his head. He can't even speak. But he goes on and on about these documents that we need to know. The documents we need to know. I'm going to tell you why the document thoughts, how from day one of this Supreme Court hearing, the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh have been a complete farce, all right? But there's a certain amount of people not saying exactly. There's not many people are being forthright about what's going on here. So, Booker, I'm just going to read a little bit from The Hill. On Thursday, Senator Cory Booker released emails from Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's time as a White House counsel, escalating a heated fight over his documents. I can't stand it. Like they're very diligent people. They deal in documents all the time. They are the ones for the job. There's nobody better for this job than Cory Booker because he has integrity and he talks about documents all the time. I just think of Cory. You know how what was it like Scrooge McDuck? You know that cartoon of Scrooge McDuck? If you're a child of the 90s, he just hoarded all this gold coins. He was just a miser, and he loved taking baths in tubs full of gold coins, and he would dive into dunes dunes of gold, piles of gold coins. I always used to love it because he would just dive into these coins like somebody would dive into a ball pit at a Burger King or a Leaping Lizard somewhere. Because, you know, in real life, you wouldn't be able to dive into a tub full of pennies and get anywhere. All right. So this was very, very, this looked like amazing. Looked like an amazing life to me as a kid. I see Cory Booker as Scrooge McDuck, but he's just diving into documents, just Cory and his documents. He just reads. That's what he does all day. He just reads documents. He's a document guy. So he put him up, pretty much put himself, Cory Booker, put himself on the table there and said, I am going to unleash all of these emails that we need to know about racial profiling for Brett Kavanaugh. And I understand that the penalty for this will come from my ousting from the Senate. Well, the thing here is that the restrictions for showing these emails were waived at 4 a.m. that morning. 4 a.m. that morning. Bill Burke, who was George W. Bush's records representative, who led the review of Kavanaugh's records, said this yesterday. We cleared the documents last night shortly after Senator Booker's staff asked us to. We were surprised to learn about Senator Booker's histrionics this morning because we had already told him he could use the documents publicly. In fact, we have said yes to every request made by the Senate Democrats to make documents public. So it gets even better. What were in these emails that he in these documents that he needed everybody to see, the documents that the Marvel mouth wanted everybody to see, who is so desperately trying to set up a viable candidacy, a viable presidential candidacy for himself because he's not a successful senator. He's a clown. He's a loon. And he will do anything for attention because his acting is horrible. His acting is almost as bad as Kamala Harris's acting. All right. So listening to this, the fury over the documents led to a showdown for, so this is from the Daily Caller. The documents only demonstrated that in 2002, soon after 9/11 attacks, Brett Kavanaugh was against the racial profiling of people while working for the Bush White House. Kavanaugh told colleagues in the email that he, quote, favors effective security measures that are race neutral, end quote, for airports. And he is against, quote, race-based, end quote, remedies for law enforcement in the aftermath of the attack. So now listen, it's not surprising to me that even the documents that they say they claim they need to make public before having to go then vote no are only going to help Brett Kavanaugh be confirmed. It's no thing to me. It's no thing to me at all. And why is that? Because it would it be a surprise to anyone that these same people want to delay the confirmation of a Supreme Court appointment that they see as a death knell when it comes to implementing their post-constitutional agenda? But the excuse that they use, that it would be some sort of dereliction of their own duty as senators if they didn't know everything they can about a man that they had already pledged to reject before they even heard his name was announced as the nominee. It makes no sense, but it makes perfect sense because at this point, they're acting so poorly. It's very obvious to see that they are not actually, they know that they're not taking anybody over to their side. They're not gaining any support. So all this is about being able to inspire the base that they already have, the base who has not completely left them altogether. This is all about inspiring and holding on to what they have because the logic is so flawed. And the behavior is so bad, and it is so anti-American in so many ways, even though they use American terms and patriotic references to themselves. I mean, it just does not matter. It doesn't matter. And they're not getting any more support from this. So this is just desperation. Desperation. It has to be desperation because they tipped their hand a long time ago. The hand was resist at all costs. Resist everyone and everything at all costs. So to tell me that the vote might go a separate way when they all voted against Neil Gorsuch, when the left-leaning American Bar Association is going to come forward and say that Brett Kavanaugh has a sterling reputation, even with them, it's not going to work. So just like everything else, just like the Mueller probe itself, this is all about stall tactics. It's about clock management. It's about pushing us a couple of more weeks, getting us to the midterms, getting us to the midterms to hopefully have something flip in their favor in any chamber of Congress. You know, it's ridiculous. And meanwhile, Kavanaugh could have, I mean, he could have found a cure for testicular cancer last month. And someone like Kamala Harris and her quivering witch voice, such a weak voice. She had a horrible performance this week. Kamala Harris and her quivering voice would have still voted no, even if he cured testicular cancer last month, because he didn't cure it soon enough. Or better yet, she would have said that it was misogynistic for giving priority to people with testicles. That's what would have happened. I just can't anymore. But you know what? I want to move away from even one more thing. This is not going to be a full hour. It's a busy day over here for me, and I just wanted to make sure that we kept up with the consistency of the broadcast for Dark to Light. And I hope that I am doing Tracy a service here. I hope she's enjoying this. I'm a little bit nervous about the state of the broadcast itself as a file, only because I'm having so much trouble with the internet over here that I already dropped out once. And I hope that it wasn't too much of an abrasive cut in the content, but we'll see. Now, I had spoken to somebody, a buddy of mine, who's actually in military. He's contracting, and he's often around the world, and he gets in touch with me. And he was dubious of President Trump at first. He's a libertarian, anarcho-capitalist type. He wrote into me last night, and this was right around the time, and I'm reading this right around the time that I wrapped up my own broadcast last night, and I started watching the rally that President Trump was having in Montana. And I'm watching this rally, and certain things are coming to my mind, and I remembered a few of them for tonight, for today, because I knew I would need to find some things to talk about. But my buddy, Jimmy, he wrote into me. He said this. He said, "Frank, I just want to say I was wrong. I thought Trump was another shill that said one thing and then continued ramping up wars. I don't follow things like Q anymore, and I thought that everyone was getting worked up. I thought that everyone was getting worked up all about these hearings for nothing. But after seeing this New York Times op-ed, I'm seeing things differently. These dudes have been scrambling to release bullshit like that. And I really hope that the whole house of cards just comes crashing down soon. You know, just the way that they've been scrambling has been enough of a telling sign for many people. Get these spooks out of D.C. and let's get back to peace," Jimmy signs off. Now, we'll see what's going on in Syria. I got to let you know right off the bat, I am skeptical, dubious, and fearful for what's going on in Syria right now. It seems like round three of chemical attacks that are completely unwarranted for whatever reason. I don't know why. Since we've not only backed off of the Syrian campaign, but we've pretty much pulled support and funding and resources from those moderate rebels that people like John McCain loved so much. I don't understand why it looks like we're staring down round three of "don't you dare gas people." I don't understand. It's confusing to me. It's a little bit disheartening. I was listening to Nikki Haley at the UN, I think earlier on today or whenever it was, and it just doesn't sound good. And for the most part, President Trump has kept his nose out of starting or escalating anything else. There's things on the table that were already in play that we need to get ourselves out of. But even though we had the April 2017 bombing of the Syrian airstrip, and then, of course, we had April of 2018. I think that the last time the whole Syrian thing happened was around the time that Tracy had her march down in Washington, D.C. that I went to go hang out with her at. So here we are again. Here we are again months later. And I don't like it. But that's what Jimmy says as far as being wrong and seeing Trump and just seeing how the sharks are. I mean, this is just wrong. The sharks that are circling him. Anybody thinks that he's on the inside of anything, how he's being crucified. I mean, you may not like him as a person, as a personality. You may not like his policies, but man, there is something else going on here. Something else. And that's why, you know, what I was thinking about when I was watching what was going on in Montana last night at this rally. And I used to say all the time, and I still say it, I don't like the current state of affairs where you have politicians that are spending their entire careers campaigning at rallies, doing just campaigning, constantly working for re-election and all that stuff. And that has all changed for me with Donald Trump. And I'll tell you why I like it now in his specific case, because this is what I voted for. I voted for culture shock. I voted for a culture shock. We were dead. All right. We were lifeless on the table, and we needed some AED. We needed some kind of a shock to the system to wake ourselves back up. Something. I have talked about this for years before Donald Trump, that if I were president, just musing, just hypothetically, I would bring back fireside chats. I would find a way to have responsible, even keel, honest conversations about our history, about what the philosophy enshrined in our Constitution means for all people, how it's actually a document. It's a setup. It's a mode of governance that goes and stands up for the minority. It stands up for the rights of the minority against the whims of a rabid mob, a mob that we see being cooked up and made rabid every day. And it has been escalating over the years, especially over the last 10 years. This is what I asked for. The culture shock, to be able to push back against the media that we know is in bed with government, this mockingbird media, we know it. It's been confirmed in many cases. The most recent confirmation, it was in 2016 when we were reading all the DNC leaks. We are reading a list that went on and on and on. Just the other night on my show, I read through all of the names from all of the media outlets, of all of the people that were spoken about and were communicated with directly in those Podesta emails and the like. People like Glenn Thrush, who actually just, you know, in a self-deprecating way, acknowledged that he's a complete hack. People that were sending all of their fluff piece articles about Hillary Clinton to the DNC before they even sent it to their editors. This is a big problem when the fourth estate becomes the fifth column. Big problem. So I have been a fan. I have said we should bring this fireside chats back instead of giving people reasons to be suspicious of those next to them who are of different racial makeup and that, this and that, and being suspicious of the government. I mean, and then, of course, the same kind of mentality that created the impetus, that created the need for the Supreme Court to be an ideological governing body. To be an ideologically driven legislative body, because, of course, Congress is just the PR section. That's it. Congress has become the public relations wing of an imperial presidency. That's it. Congress is where people get up in front of everybody every day and talk about what they believe American values are, while the president in the Oval Office writes law through executive fiat with his pen and his phone, and then challenges anybody out there to bring it down in court. Because, of course, as it makes its way through the appellates and all the other lower courts, it makes its way up to the Supreme Court, and there you have it. There goes all of your friends, all of your fellow travelers who are willing to look and redefine words, vocabulary itself, to be able to say, yes, this is legal, and this is what the framers had intended when they drafted this living, breathing, always evolving document. Always evolving. Because what is a contract between people or between sovereign states if the language inside the contract isn't always shifting and being redefined? That's like signing a contract with Darth Vader. Lando Calrissian learned what signing a contract with Darth Vader was all about in Cloud City. He learned all about that. I'm altering the deal. That's it. That's exactly what the framers had in context when they were writing all this stuff. So I'm listening to the president push back against the very people, the very institutions that have been bludgeoning us over the head, even when they were wrong, even when they were caught, even when they have been caught lying. They control the narrative. They control the premise on which we have all of our conversations. We have to debate them. Even if we're winning the debate, we have to debate them on seeing everything through the realm of race, through the realm of sexuality, through the realm of anything else that is personal to a person. That is how they control us, even when they lose an argument. And this guy, Donald Trump, is pushing back on it. And that is what I voted for. I voted for culture shock because the current culture is sick and dying. So look no further than this. Look no further to know why we're having these unbelievably disingenuous, obtuse arguments about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, how people are going to have their basic rights taken away if the Supreme Court. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? How can anybody's rights be taken away unless you legislate rights be taken away? Unless the Congress legislates rights be taken away. And of course, they don't want to be limited by the 10th Amendment. States are just glorified voting districts to these people. Cory Booker in New Jersey believes he is able to tell people who live in Nebraska and Colorado what to do. Cory Booker believes his opinion is valid, just as valid in Montana and Idaho as it is in New Jersey. That's it. I want to give you guys a little bit of a context as we wrap up here. I know it's not exactly an hour, but I think it's good enough. I want to give you guys a little bit of context, okay, all you guys and gals out there. Here's an electoral explanation I always keep near and dear, okay? There are 3,141 counties in the United States. Donald Trump won 3,084 of them. Clinton won 57, okay? There are 62 counties in New York State. Trump won 46 of them. Clinton won 16. Clinton won a popular vote by approximately 1.5 million to 2 million votes. In the five counties that encompass New York City, that's Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Richmond, and Queens, Clinton received well over 2 million more votes than Trump. Okay. And Clinton only won four of these counties. Trump won Richmond County. Therefore, these five counties alone more than accounted for Clinton winning the popular vote in the entire country. These five counties comprise 316 square miles. The United States is comprised of 3.7 million, almost 3.8 million square miles. When you have a country that encompasses almost 4 million square miles of territory, it would be ludicrous to even suggest that the vote of those that encompass a mere 319 square miles should dictate the outcome of a national election. That's just talking about the popular vote in general, but it also gives you a greater scope as to what kind of entitlement these coastal elite lunatics think they're able to wield in Congress and the Senate. It tells you the kind of entitlement it has. And believe me, I see it firsthand. I'm right here in the thick of it over here in New York, right here in the thick of it. I've had people from all over the country say, Frank, you've restored my faith in Yankees. You've restored my faith in Yanks. Well, trust me, there's a lot more than just me over here who sees what's going wrong. And when you think about it from my perspective, I have to sit here and watch Andrew Cuomo and Miranda Hobbs from Sex and the City duke it out to see who can spend the most. Oh, my God. Don't worry, I'm going to be bringing on some alternative candidates in the weeks leading up to November. But as for that, I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Tracy for giving me the opportunity to not only be a partner of hers in this endeavor, but also to trust me with speaking to you all one-on-one, as I know that this is a show that has really great listenership. And I honestly don't even know who listens. It could be anybody out there. I could be embarrassing myself right now. As far as the kind of people who listen to this show, I know great reputations out there. And I'm really honored and humbled to have spent this last 45 to 50 minutes with you. And I hope that everything works out for the best technologically and that this all goes smoothly. So thank you to everybody out there. Thank you to Radio Influence. And find us on iTunes and give us some stars and subscribe and leave some reviews. Share it with friends and family. And we'll see you all soon. Follow Tracy on YouTube and on Twitter. You can follow me at Political Orgy on Twitter. Or you can search Quite Frankly on YouTube or QuiteFranklyPodcast.com. That can lead you to all the places. But stay tuned for another exciting week in America.
I'm Jerry P. Tuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.